1. Good afternoon. My name is Brittany, and I'm going to be your moderator. I'm here with State Senator Jay Costa, and we want to welcome you to this live telephone town hall. If you have a question for Senator Costa or any of our excellent guests this afternoon, press star 3 on your phone at any time. We'll remind you of that a couple of times. Now let's welcome Senator Jay Costa.
Well, thank you very much, Brittany, and thank you to all the folks in our community that are participating in this afternoon's telephone call. As was mentioned, I'm State Senator Jay Costa, and I'm holding this telephone town hall to discuss the COVID-19 vaccine. And we are very fortunate to have with us today Pennsylvania Secretary of Health, Dr. Rachel Levine. But in addition to that, we have the Director of the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency, PEMA, Randy Padfield, who's been probably sleep-deprived, as he mentioned earlier, given the snowstorm. And finally, Cindy Finley from the Department of Health Disease and Prevention Program. We're going to have the opportunity to have each of them speak very briefly, talk about some of the current events with respect to the virus, and then more importantly, talk about the vaccine, its distribution in Pennsylvania, and then be able to take questions from folks who have some ideas about what they'd like to learn from our guests. So, again, thank you, Dr. Levine, for being with us. I know your time is valuable, so I want to turn it over to you to provide an update on the virus itself in terms of Pennsylvania numbers, and then maybe a little bit about the vaccine and what steps have taken place thus far.
Well, thank you very much, Senator, for inviting us today. I'm so pleased to be here with my friends and colleagues, Director Padfield and Deputy Secretary Finley. And we would certainly like to thank you, Senator, for all of your support for public health and all of our response for COVID-19. COVID-19 continues to be the biggest public health threat that we have in Pennsylvania. We are certainly in our fall, now winter, resurgence. Today, we saw an increase of 9,966 new cases of COVID-19. That brings our total to 529,335. Tragically, we had reported today 224 deaths, which brings our total to 13,392 people who have lost their lives attributed to COVID-19. We have significant rates of hospitalization. 6,346 patients are in the hospital throughout Pennsylvania. 1,238 people are in the intensive care unit, and 740 people are on a ventilator or breathing machine. With the significant increases that are being seen throughout the nation, and in Pennsylvania, there are three ways to deal with the pandemic. We work on containment. That involves continuing to expand testing and contact tracing. I strongly recommend that you download the PA COVID-19 app, which is free for your phones, that does the automatic contact tracing. It doesn't track your whereabouts. It uses Bluetooth, not GPS. And so we're continuing to do that. We continue with mitigation, which is very challenging for the communities in terms of, of course, everyone wearing masks, everyone social distancing, avoiding large and small gathering, washing hands, et cetera. And then some of the limitations on gatherings, which are difficult, especially this time of year, but necessary to stop the spread. And then we have the vaccine, and the vaccine really is the light at the end of the tunnel. For us, it's going to take time. We have to be patient as well as, of course, persistent. But the vaccine is here. It's not just coming. It is here in Pennsylvania this week. So this is the result of Operation Warp Speed. And I don't know if I love the title because it implies that it was done somehow on the quick. But this is really the result of years and years of advanced work on vaccine technology sponsored by the federal government. And has cost billions, but there are one and hopefully by the weekend two safe and effective vaccines for distribution in Pennsylvania and throughout the United States. These have gone through all the different trials that are necessary, preclinical trials and then clinical trials with patients. The first one, the Pfizer vaccine, has been deemed safe and effective by the federal government, the FDA, and the CDC. And is being distributed this week, and they're looking at the Moderna vaccine today. And hopefully by the weekend, that will have been deemed safe and effective as well. I have to tell you that as the Secretary of Health and the President of ASTO, the Association of all the other state and territorial health officials, I and ASTA, we have confidence in these vaccines, that they are safe and effective for distribution, and really will show us the way out of this terrible, terrible pandemic. So again, there, we'll talk about two vaccines right now, although they're more in the pipeline. The Pfizer vaccine has started distribution. That's the one that has to be kept in ultra-cold technology, minus 80 degrees centigrade, which limits a little bit where, not a little bit, it limits where how it can be distributed throughout Pennsylvania. It makes it challenging for rural areas. And then there's the Moderna vaccine that this can be kept frozen, so that's going to be a little bit easier. There are three phases to the distribution, obviously 1, 2, and 3. Phase 1 has started. And according to the CDC, phase 1 includes healthcare personnel thought of broadly in hospitals, but also outside of hospitals, and not just doctors and nurses, but also, you know, everyone that is on the front lines in hospitals and other healthcare settings, seeing patients and helping us in this pandemic. And then also, which will start in a week and a half on the 28th, distribution through Walgreens and CVS, as determined by the federal government, to nursing homes and other long-term care facilities where some of our most vulnerable patients live, seniors who are very vulnerable to COVID-19, as well as the brave staff that work in those nursing homes. So phase one has started. We have distributed, as of today, 1,205 doses of the vaccine. We've had no problems with the distribution, and we've had no problems with the administration, and no side effects are reported to us so far. So that's great. The Pfizer product will continue next week, as well as Moderna, as long as it's deemed safe by the FDA today and the CDC over this weekend. And then again, the mission to the long-term care facilities will start on the 28th. There's a phase 1B, which includes frontline personnel. So, of course, our heroic police officers and fire departments, but then other people who are on the front lines, you know, maybe working in food manufacturing and many other places. Other congregate care settings, corrections will be included in phase 1B, as well as seniors that are particularly vulnerable with chronic medical conditions who are living at home. Phase 2 are other priority vulnerable populations, and then phase 3 is really the entire community. We don't know exactly what the timeline is going to be. It kind of depends on the manufacturing and how much vaccine we get and whether more vaccines are coming, but we're going to continue to work on that. I want to highlight the collaboration that we have with Pima, with Director Padfield and Pima. A fantastic work on emergency services and on logistics, and they are partners in this mission. And I certainly want to highlight the work of our vaccine coordinator, Deputy Secretary Cindy Finley, and her team on this. So, Director Padfield, do you have some comments you'd like to make?
Sure. Thank you, Dr. Levine. And Dr. Levine did an excellent job of providing the high-level overview from a strategic perspective. There's just a couple of things I'd like to point out, and Dr. Levine hit on the collaboration. So we've been partners in this response ever since the beginning, and it's a primary public health response, but there are so many interdependencies. And, you know, as we've watched this unfold, and we've watched the data unfold in our understanding of COVID since the beginning of this pandemic, you know, the decisions that are made have other implications or impacts. And really, that's where our agency comes in, is to be able to assist with those other impacts across the spectrum. So we've been involved in a number of those types of situations throughout this response. We've been taking a look at food security and working with our county emergency managers to be able to make sure, and the other state agencies such as DHS and Department of Agriculture, to really make sure that we have the ability to be able to provide the food that's needed and that nobody's going hungry. We've been able to provide assistance with multiple lines of support for Department of Health. That includes, you know, taking a look at PPE. Early on, it was challenging, and we worked with our federal counterparts to be able to get a critical care decontamination system here to decontaminate N95 masks. We were able to work to establish community-based testing sites, which we were not necessarily in the first priority for those, but we were able to lobby based on our population and the outbreaks that we had at the time to be able to get the federal support for community-based testing sites. We've worked with DHS for unique solutions to some of their debit card or PEBT benefit program challenges that they had to be able to work with workflows and processes and utilize our crisis management system to be able to support those. So throughout this, we've really worked collaboratively, not just with Department of Health, but also all the other state agencies, working with Department of Community and Economic Development. One of the things that we did early on, taking a look at all of the requests that we had with people coming into us and organizations saying, we have personal protective equipment, you know, buy from us. And literally, they would flood our email boxes daily. We established a process with DCED where they would actually vet all of those inquiries that we were receiving to find out whether they were legitimate and whether they actually had product. And if they did, then where did they fall in the pipeline and when could we, if we executed contracts, get that product? So to date, we have not paid for anything that we have not been able to take delivery on, and that's not necessarily the case with the federal government or a lot of the other states, especially early on in the pandemic. So it's really been a collaborative approach across multiple state agencies, really kind of the whole of state government, but also in our working relationships with our county emergency managers, much like occurred last night with the snowstorm response. They are really dedicated folks, and they really want to bring together the agencies that they can at their levels. As I told all our emergency managers earlier in the response, is that, you know, this will be the longest, most complex response that we've had in our probably collective careers, and it's going to be able to take us, you know, into areas that we're probably not comfortable with or we did not think about before, but we have to find the solutions, especially like the long-term care facility situation, those types of things, to be able to provide the services that are needed. So as Dr. Levine indicated, the vaccine, as they roll out the vaccine, this will be no different. There are a lot of complexities to this. And the one thing that, and I'm sure Cindy will talk to this as well, is that with how rapidly this developed, a lot of the information that we received from the CDC and HHS on this is their initial or first thinking. So a lot of times it is very fluid and things change. So they made it very clear to us throughout this process that we need to be nimble and be able to rapidly adapt to changes in vaccine amounts and numbers we're going to get, different things that we'll need to change, and different pieces that we're going to have to probably do some crisis action planning on for the implementation of the vaccine strategy. So we're very well prepared to be able to do that and work with the Department of Health to be able to roll out the vaccine efficiently and effectively in the Commonwealth in the upcoming months. So with that, I'll stop there, Dr. Levine. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Director Padfield. Deputy Secretary Finley, any comments you'd like to add?
Thank you, Secretary Levine and Director Padfield. I wanted to kind of clarify with regards to the way Pennsylvania's laid out with the vaccination program. This isn't anything new, but Pennsylvania covers, the Department of Health covers 66 of the counties, and Philadelphia Department of Health covers Philadelphia County. So we essentially have two immunization programs in the state, and that's been the way this has been set up for a number of years. And we work very closely with Philadelphia. They have their own vaccine allocations as well as we do, and they received and created their own vaccine plan. And as Director Patfield had mentioned, it is very fluid. We have spent many months making sure our systems are talking, making sure that we have information from the CDC that we need in order to be prepared to make sure the doses are accounted for, and also with regards to the tracking and making sure everything is set up so that we're prepared to have a positive vaccination event and be thorough with providing the vaccine to anyone that would like to receive it. Thank you.
Well, thank each of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, yes, please proceed, Senator.
Yep. Thank you, Dr. Levine. Brittany, you want to maybe let folks know how to call in the questions again, and then maybe a couple of questions we receive in advance of today's call. You can maybe begin that process as well.
Absolutely. If you are listening live on the line, you can press star 3 at any point to ask a question, and we'll get you right in the lineup here. We did receive a number of questions ahead of time. I'm going to organize them into a couple of groups so we're able to get to our live callers. But one frequent one that we're getting is, what do you have to do to get on the list to receive the vaccine, and how will you be notified that it's your turn?
So you don't have to get on the list right now to be to get vaccinated. Again, it's going to go out in those three phases. So right now, you know, we're working with hospitals to immunize healthcare workers, not only from the hospital but from the area as well. And we're going to be working with the two pharmacies for long-term care facilities. As we go into 1B, however, then things would change a bit. Deputy Secretary Finney, do you want to talk about, you know, how someone, for instance, who's part of the group in 1B would get vaccinated?
Sure. So what we're looking at is we'll be having communication up on our website. We'll be communicating to our partners in each of the counties to just give out the information and also to identify the sites that will be receiving the vaccine. As we mentioned earlier, it depends on how much vaccine we receive and the type of vaccine, which will allow us to partner with different entities. Those that may be able to handle a vaccine with smaller doses would be a partner that we could work with, rather than those that have the ability to handle the larger vaccines.
So so stay tuned. You know, as the vaccine rolls out, we're going to have a communication plan, and we'll be communicating to the right groups about how they can get vaccinated. So stay tuned.
All right, another frequent question is the vaccine mandatory, and will there be a record kept by the CDC or the state of who has received it?
So the vaccine is not mandatory. Not mandatory by the federal government and not mandatory by the state. It is possible that certain employers might mandate the vaccine for specific companies. So that, I've heard some discussion in the news. But from our point of view, it's not mandatory. But it's strongly recommended. I mean, we really want people to take these safe and effective vaccines and protect themselves and thereby protecting their family from COVID-19. We will be keeping a record of who has the vaccine. We have an excellent vaccine record system that we're having, and it will connect with the CDC, and we will be keeping our records of who gets vaccinated. Cindy, anything you want to add?
Just to note that as anyone receiving the vaccine will also receive a vaccination card, and on that card they can keep that to show that they received the vaccine. In addition to the fact that these are two-dose vaccines, that will also indicate the next time that you would need to come back to get your second dose. So it's a good tool to have. Take a picture of it if you have a cell phone, and then keep it in your records for your medical history.
So that's a critical point. The Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines are both two-dose vaccines. You need a second dose after 3 weeks for Pfizer after 4 weeks for Moderna. There will be, systems to remind people, but we really need people to get the second dose so they're fully protected.
All right, I think we're ready to go to live callers. Let's go to Sarah, who's calling us from North Oakland.
Oh, hi, Dr. Levine. I have a question for you. Thanks for everything you're doing. So I wondered, once someone gets a vaccine, are they no longer dangerous to other people? I ask because my partner is an ICU nurse and he's treating COVID patients now, and so we've been avoiding everyone. Once he gets the vaccine, once he gets both doses, will he no longer be a threat to, our family and friends? Could we see them?
I would say yes, but. Nothing's 100%. I mean, actually, these vaccines, they've said to be over 90% effective, which is absolutely fantastic. But we're going to still want people to wear masks, to wash their hands, and to social into social distance. And so, you know, I would say certainly somebody who is, has the vaccine is much less likely to get the virus. If they do get the virus, they're much less likely to have a severe case because it's going to be very protective from that point of view. But I would still be cautious. It's not sort of a license that you don't have to worry about it at all. But certainly it will offer a significant protection.
All right, now let's go to Bob in Swissvale.
Yes, Dr. Levine and Senator Costa, I appreciate the time you're spending on this. My question pertains to, particularly me, I'm age 75. As a young child, I was told, and when I say young, I'm thinking like maybe 4 or 5 as far back as I can remember, that I had or was allergic to sulfa drugs. I've never had any kind of a reaction to any vaccines or anything as long as I can ever remember. However, my question would be, I want to take the vaccine as soon as possible, but should I, knowing that, should I wait? Don't have an answer.
Well, thank you for that
question. I'm counting on you, Doc, for that one.
Okay. Well, one thing is that for people, we always recommend that you talk with your doctor, right? Because I don't know everything about your medical history, you know, of course. So we always recommend, you know, we're going to talk about public things from a public health perspective. And so for personal advice, you'd want to talk with your doctor who knows your medical history best. But in general, so there had been a couple of allergic reactions in England. We've heard today that there were one, maybe two allergic reactions in Alaska to the Pfizer vaccine. We're still gaining information about that, and you know the vaccine's only been going for a short time. Certainly for the general population, this vaccine is safe and effective, and I have no problems with that. For people, you know, if you have a history of anaphylaxis, which means having to, you know, get epinephrine or carry an EpiPen because you might get very, very sick from an allergy, then you should talk with your doctor. And certainly, if you get the vaccine, we're recommending that there be, you know, in a medical setting or in a setting where people could give you medicines to deal with an allergic reaction. If you don't have an history of quote-unquote anaphylaxis, then I think that we're much less concerned. But again, you know, as you get the vaccine, you know, medical personnel will need to be there in case there is any kind of problem. I do want to emphasize that people have allergic reactions to everything. I mean, you can have allergic reaction to bee stings. You can have allergic reactions to foods, to many different medicines. So it's not just this vaccine. And, you know, as time goes by, we're going to learn a lot more. You know, for a healthy individual who's 75, maybe with a couple, you know, medical issues, that's phase 1B right now. And so it'll be a little bit while before the immunizations will be available, and I think we'll know a lot more. Does that answer your question?
I think so. Let's go to another
okay.
one now.
Thanks.
Brennan, your line is unmuted. Go ahead and ask.
Yeah, so my question was about, like, the safety of the vaccine. And since, like, I know the normal process for developing a vaccine usually takes, like, over 10 years, just how could you ensure that there's no long-term negative consequences to it because it was made, like,
sure.
less than a year?
Sure. So that's a very good question. So you're correct. The clinical trials, you know, have gone on for 4 or 6 months. And so we know that these vaccines are safe and effective over that period of time. And that is why it has received an emergency use authorization or an EUA from the FDA as opposed to having to basically just been generally approved. However, I do want to emphasize that the clinical trial process that was done for these vaccines is exactly the same as it would be done for any vaccine in terms of the number of people involved. If anything, there were more people involved. But you're correct. We don't know long-term potential side effects. We usually would be about 4 years where they would be watching for any other vaccine. But because of, you know, the significance of this global pandemic, again, well over 307,000 people who passed away in the United States over 1.6 million people who've died internationally. You know, from a public health point of view, it's just critically important to get the vaccine out. And, you know, I, as the Secretary of Health and others in public health, feel really confident about the safety and efficacy of the vaccine. But you're correct. We don't know 4 or 5 years from now, although we really don't anticipate any potential side effects. But, those long-term studies will be ongoing.
Okay, next let's go to Linda, who's calling us from Penn Hills.
Hi, Dr. Levine. It's my understanding that once a person receives a vaccine that you have to wear a mask continually until everyone's been vaccinated. Is that correct?
We recommend that people continue to wear masks when they're out in public, even after you've received the vaccine. That is correct.
Okay, my second question is, so that means basically, who knows, God knows how long we'll be wearing these masks. I have no problem wearing a mask. But secondly, my next question, Dr. Levine, is when they report on the local news, channels 2, 4, and 11, how many people died, okay, they never specify what age group, you know, what age range they are, okay? And I find that very disheartening. I see the numbers of people, you know, that have the COVID, okay? And I think the numbers are based on the number of people that are being tested. So those numbers skyrocketing. And I'm just a little upset about, you know, the information, the statistics that I'm seeing reported on TV, because it feels like it's like a control, it's like a fear factor, you know, like, okay, this is how many people have the COVID. So what are we going to do about it? You know, and I just feel that the fear is being emulated every day on TV. In fact, I dread, I don't even want to see the figures on TV, because it's just so depressing. And that's my second question, Dr. Levine. Thank you.
Sure. Well, I can understand your concerns. I mean, in terms of the data, I mean, this is the most significant public health aspect of our lives. I mean, nothing like this has happened since 1918 in terms of the global pandemic. You know, the numbers on TV are very concerning and very sobering. So I can understand your reaction. We have all this data on our website. So if you go to our website at www.pa.health.gov, I think that's right, Cindy. Then you can see all of this, all of the information. So, I mean, we know that in terms of the number of deaths, I'm looking at the data right now because I pulled it up on the computer. The vast majority of deaths have been in those 65 and older. So we know that seniors with chronic medical conditions, and seniors, particularly in long-term care facilities, but not exclusively, are most prone to dying from COVID-19. But there have been, in Pennsylvania, as well as throughout the nation, young adults who have passed away, and there have been even children who have gotten very, very ill with a condition called multi-system inflammatory disorder, associated with COVID. So, really, it impacts all populations. The hospitalizations are not just seniors. Hospitalizations are in young adults as well. We have new medical treatments. We have the monoclonal antibodies, which have been very effective. We have remdesivir and another medicine, a steroid called dexamethasone. But I don't want to... we're not trying just to install fear, but we really need people to follow the basic public health messages, like wearing masks. I mean, how long? It's hard for me to predict the future, but I would think that we'll be wearing masks through much, if not most, of 2021. I think by, if everything is going really, really well as we enter 2022, things will be different. But this is certainly the public health event of our time, and nothing. The world has seen nothing like this since 1918.
All right, thank you. Next, we have a question from John in Squirrel Hill.
Yes, hi, Dr. Levine.
Hi.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Levine. I'm a dentist, and I was wondering where dentistry falls in the category of healthcare workers receiving the vaccine.
Cindy, can you tell us where dentists sit right now?
Right now, dentists would be in 1B. So it's still in phase one.
All right, that was an easy one.
Thank you, Cindy.
Next, let's go to Carol from Shadyside.
It's you.
Yes, we can hear you.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
My question was, are we going to have a choice of the vaccine that we receive?
It depends where and when you're getting the vaccine. So we have chosen Pfizer for the vaccine for the long-term care facility mission. We did that for some particular reasons in terms of its transportation requirements and the ultra-cold storage. So the vaccine that will be distributed through Walgreens and CVS to nursing homes and long-term care facilities will be Pfizer. For the hospitals, it'll be a combination of Pfizer and Moderna, but certainly one of the vaccine that will probably be used most for healthcare workers, especially in rural areas, will be Moderna. And then there are more vaccines coming. So as we go roll out to phase, 1B into phase two, I think that different facilities will have different vaccines. The main limiting factor for Pfizer is the storage requirements and the refrigeration requirements, which influences where it can go. Then, of course, there's more vaccines in the pipeline. So, yes, you will have a choice, but there are specific vaccines going for a specific mission.
Dr. Levine, very briefly, Britt. Dr. Levine, University of Pittsburgh had been involved in creating a vaccine early on. Is there any update on the status of the vaccine that they were working on?
I have no update on the vaccine they were working on. It's not part of Operation Warp Speed. Now, there are other vaccines, as you pointed out, being worked on by other companies. The uniqueness of Operation Warp Speed is how they paid for it. I mean, they paid for it up front, essentially. So they asked these companies to develop vaccines, and essentially they get paid whether their vaccine ends up being used or not. And that was the only way to develop vaccines with six different companies working to develop vaccines this quickly. Other companies and universities, et cetera, are working on vaccines, and they might be extremely helpful as we proceed. And also, vaccinating the entire world. It's not just the United States that will need to be vaccinated, but they're not getting paid up front for it.
Thank you.
Okay, now let's go to Robert in Penn Hills.
Yeah. Hi, Dr. Levine.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask a question. I am the Democratic Committee of Allegheny County, but I also own one of the largest daycare centers in Pittsburgh. My employees, where do they rank among the first that should get this immunization?
Thank you for that question. Cindy, daycare workers, do you
sure,
have
enough? Sure, I do. And anyone can look at this in our plan. Child care workers are on page 14, and they are under phase 1B, so that is in phase 1.
Okay,
I do want to point out something.
Oops, I'm sorry.
Before you go, is that the vaccines have not been tested in children yet. The Pfizer had been in 16 and 17-year-olds, Moderna 18 and above. So Pfizer is approved for 16 and 17-year-olds. But in terms of younger children, those trials are being conducted now. So we do not have safety and effectiveness data in kids. And so that none of the vaccines are going to be used to anybody under 16 until we get that data. I can't tell you when that will come. You can't put a date on when science will be completed. But that's going to have to wait. Right now in terms of anybody younger than 16.
All right, next we have a question from Ella in Penn Hills.
Hello, Dr. Levine. I want to thank you for your concern. Hi, I would like to thank you for your concern, courage, and dedication along with Governor Wolf and all your colleagues. My question is, how long is the vaccine going to last once you get both doses? And does your blood type have anything to do with your well-being associated with the vaccine?
So thank you. Appreciate your kind comments. The fact is that we don't know. We know that the immunity lasts at least 6 months because the trials have been going on for 6 months or more. There's every reason to think that it'll last at least 1 to 2 years. But we don't know if people are going to need boosters in the future. We will only know as those studies continue and more people get immunized. And so a really good question, but we don't know. There had been some preliminary studies that for unclear reasons, that blood type might have influenced how you responded if you got COVID-19. But I don't think that in the end that was proven, and there are no known issues in terms of blood type in any of the vaccines.
All right, I want to remind everyone on the call, if you have a question, you can press *3 and we'll get you in the lineup and get it answered as soon as we can. Next, let's go to Rosemary, who's calling us from Carrick.
Hello, Dr. Levine. Can you hear me?
Hi.
My question is, I'm 65, and I've never been tested for COVID-19, and I feel as healthy as a lark. I feel great. Is it still recommended that I get this vaccine if I feel
absolutely
no matter what?
Absolutely.
Okay.
No matter what. So we strongly recommend that seniors, and I'm right behind you, I'm 63, get the vaccine because we know that seniors, even if you're very healthy, and that's just wonderful that you're very healthy, are more at risk from getting COVID-19. So we would recommend that you get the vaccine when it's available to seniors.
Okay, next let's go to Mark, who's calling us from Swissville.
Hi, I'm Mark, and I'm 65, I'm legally blind and have pulmonary issues, so I think I'm in 1B. How will I be notified, or is there a voucher system, or do I just contact my doctor at some point? How is that going to work once it's my turn?
A really good question. Yes, you are in 1B. Cindy, can you answer the question?
So as we're receiving vaccine and we understand our cadence of how often we'll be receiving the vaccine, we'll be building these plans out in our communities. And we'll be communicating with our community partners to notify and also be putting things up on our website to identify where vaccines will be available. As mentioned earlier, we'll mind the social distancing, so it's all will be a scheduling process. It's not just showing up at an entity in a big line. It'll be more structured with scheduling and to make sure that everyone is, ready to get their vaccine.
So in other words, stay tuned, and it won't just be on the website. We will be having robust communication about when you could when and how and where you could get the vaccine. It could be at your doctor's office. It could be at a pharmacy. It might be at a local federally qualified health center, and you would be able to make an appointment and come and get the vaccine. So basically, stay tuned. We've just started 1A. And we're still working on exactly what the communications will be about 1B.
Okay, next let's go to Elizabeth from Forest Hills.
Oh, thank you very much for taking the calls, Dr. Levine. It's been very informative so far. I appreciate it. Dr. Levine, I'm interested in this period before the vaccine is available to many of us who wouldn't be in the first, and basically just for everybody, this period as the vaccine rolls out. I listened last Tuesday to a Senate committee testimony by a highly respected critical care pulmonologist who's representing 9 other internationally known and highly respected specialists called the FLCCC, the frontline COVID-19 critical care doctors. They have been studying the results from random controlled studies on ivermectin, which is a Nobel Prize winning drug, which has been repurposed and is being used at all stages of COVID care, from pre-exposure all the way to people being hospitalized. The FLCCC data is showing that ivermectin has immediate and potent antiviral activity and should be being used right now while we wait for these vaccines to get to all of these people who need them. The NIH has not looked at ivermectin since August, and since then, when they did that, it was based on expert opinion, not on the data, which has accumulated since before that and since then in many randomized trials that have not been reviewed by the NIH. And so I guess my question, these are not quacks. These mm-hmm. FLCCC doctors, it's COVID-19criticalcare.com. They are, you know, they're the chief of staff of United Memorial Medical Center in Houston and the chief pulmonologist at East Virginia Medical Center in Norfolk. These are highly respected doctors. And they are asking, and I guess I'm asking you as well, I'm asking you what Dr. Corey asked at that Senate committee meeting last week on December 8th. I'm asking, you know, when is the data on ivermectin going to get looked at? They've got studies of 800 healthcare workers who were put on ivermectin. None of them got COVID. 400 who were the controls. These are controlled studies. 400 who were controlled, 273 of those people got COVID, the control group. So, you know, these are randomized control studies that, and these are the same doctors, I will say, who called for the use of corticosteroids in March, well before the NIH finally came down. So my question is, will you review and the data on ivermectin that these well-respected doctors, the FLCCC doctors, and I'm urging other people to look at this too and ask anyone who is in a position of medical power in this country to start looking at repurposed drugs, not these novel, expensive remdesivir and all of these things, the ones that are out there that are known. When are those going to get a look in while we wait for these vaccines?
Well, thank you for that question. I've heard about ivermectin. I mean, I'd be glad to review things, but it's not me who decides. You know, I'm the Secretary of Health for Pennsylvania. This is a national issue that would have to go to the FDA. So, you know, they would need to send their data to the FDA to get an emergency use authorization. And other companies have, so they would need to go through the FDA to get an emergency use authorization for that drug to be approved for this condition. So that happens nationally, not through Pennsylvania. But I will ask my colleagues at ASTO what they think about ivermectin, because I've heard that. Thanks.
Okay, next let's go to Michael from Wilkinsburg.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. Senator Costa and Dr. Levine, thank you so much. I know this year has not been easy and you can't please anyone, but I think that you have been very graceful and your efforts are very appreciated.
Thank you.
I have a couple of questions for you, Dr. Levine, and I have a question for Senator Costa as well. Dr. Levine, about the Pfizer vaccine, I'm aware that it has a couple of distribution protocols, like it needs to be kept very cold. And I'm wondering, when that goes from the warehouse where it's being created to the local pharmacies, and when they're in the hands of our neighbors who work at these pharmacies and Walgreens and CVS, who is going to be enforcing the proper care of the vaccine? And then also, is the vaccine going to be an ongoing immunization process after the first two, or is this like similar to the flu shot, or is this going to be, you know, one and done?
So thank you for those questions. So in terms of the second question, we don't know. So it's two shots, you know, one shot and for the Pfizer and the shot 3 weeks later. But we don't know if that will be sufficient for long-term immunity over years, or whether boosters would be necessary. You know, we know only for sure for the period of time that people have had it, which is about 6 months or more. So we will have to see, and those studies are ongoing, whether the how long the immunity lasts and whether future shots will be necessary. So, you know, you're correct. The Pfizer vaccine has to be ultra cold chain at minus 80 degrees centigrade, which is about 100 degrees, minus 100 degrees Fahrenheit, so it's ultra cold chain. That does determine where it goes, and that's why it's going to hospitals right now, 87 hospitals in the first week, who have the ability, have the refrigeration to keep it at minus, at that temperature after they crack the packaging to be able to be used. It comes in packaging with dry ice to keep it at that ultra cold chain with even a replacement packet of dry ice. In terms of the pharmacies, again, it's going to the distribution centers for CVS and Walgreens, and then going to the and then going to the nursing homes and the long-term care facilities to be used right away. So you know, it's not like going to your neighborhood CVS for the most part, or your neighborhood Walgreens. Randy, do you have further information in or do you want to talk about in terms of the transportation and distribution?
I'm sorry, Dr. Levine, I was distracted. You're talking about the
sure.
Transportation distribution. The
the transportation and distribution of the Pfizer vaccine ultra cold chain.
Sure. So, you know, we've been tracking the information, obviously, from the CDC regarding that. And Operation Warp Speed is really involved with making sure that it gets moved from the manufacturing facilities in Michigan and Wisconsin through the contracts that they have with the carriers to the endpoints within the state. We've been monitoring that, and the Department of Health has access through their Tiberius system that the federal government has to be able to monitor those shipments. Yesterday was a classic example of being able to monitor that, especially as we get into the winter weather, to be able to make sure that once it gets into Pennsylvania, if there are issues with trying to get it to its endpoint, that we have the ability and the point of contact to be able to troubleshoot that. Yesterday or last night with the storm, there was a significant concern over the kind of the travel restriction and bans, where we actually, you know, restrict certain type of movement of commercial vehicles throughout the state to be able to lessen the possibility of having, you know, a disastrous or catastrophic accidents that are large and very complex. And we have points of contact with UPS to be able to troubleshoot anything once it gets on the ground in Pennsylvania and to be able to make sure it makes it to its final destination. We're aware of the packaging, the concerns with the packaging. Obviously, the dry ice is a concern. We have contingencies in place if we would have to provide any additional dry ice, if we would have a package that is stuck out on the roadway. So we're constantly monitoring that. We have the capabilities to be able to utilize the National Guard if needed, if there were challenges with delivery to the endpoint. So we always look at what the federal plans happen to be. We make planning assumptions on those, but we also work consequence management planning and look at any holes that we would perceive or vulnerabilities in any of those plans to be able to make sure we always have a secondary and a tertiary plan to be able to essentially get the vaccine to where it needs to go.
Brittany,
okay,
I don't know if
next,
the gentleman
let's go
the,
to. Oh.
Brittany, I don't know. There was a question for me. If not, they can communicate it to folks, and then we'll follow up with any question that's not answered today on the call. We will get the answers from everybody involved.
Yeah, it looks like we've dropped our last caller. If you want to call back in, just press *3, and we'll get to your second question. Next, let's go to Loretta in Oakland.
Hi, thank you for taking our questions. I had a question. It's kind of similar to what I think their name was Bob asked earlier about like food allergies and groups that may not be able to take the vaccine. You mentioned that it hasn't been tested on children yet. I have an autoimmune disease, so I'm kind of interested in learning if there are any groups of people that are unable to take the vaccine.
So right now, you know, there's a caution to people who have had anaphylaxis. I know of no specific cautions if you have an autoimmune disease. I think that would be really one of the indications to get the vaccine. This is not a live virus vaccine. You cannot get the virus you cannot get COVID-19 from this vaccine in any way. So really the only main concern would be a hypersensitivity, and an allergic reaction. And so you want to, you know, the people giving it to you to make sure that they can treat that if they need to. Cindy, anything I'm missing in terms of autoimmune disease? That would be actually be an indication to get the vaccine.
No, I think you covered it, doctor.
So we would recommend it. So you would be in phase 1B. And so when we when we're at that phase, then, you know, please, keep listening, and we'll have a lot of robust communication about how you can get the vaccines, one of the different vaccines, when it's available for you.
Okay, we've got a couple of minutes left, so I think we can get to a few more questions. Let's go to Emily in Bloomfield now.
Hi, Dr. Levine. I want to thank you for all of your work and leadership. It's very appreciated. I am particularly concerned for our friends, neighbors, and family members who are incarcerated at this time. I'm particularly worried about the people incarcerated at ACJ, Allegheny County Jail, which has a, frankly, very terrible record on keeping inmates healthy, as well as SCI Fayette, where I know of a number of people who have passed away recently with COVID-19 symptoms who have not been tested for it, and also the people who are incarcerated who are currently being held in Burke's Detention Center who may not be citizens, and so I'm wondering about people in all of those facilities as well as other institutions where people are being incarcerated in Pennsylvania.
Sure. So it's very important for the vaccine to be available for those in congregate settings like that, and those that are incarcerated. And so the people who work in those facilities, as well as the inmates in facilities, are part of 1B. Cindy, I'm correct with that?
You are correct.
And so that's as you said, a very important aspect. There are no, and this has been asked maybe before, I mean, there's no citizen requirements to get the vaccine. No one's going to be checking papers or anything like that. We want everyone in the United States to get the vaccine to protect the public health.
Dr. Levine and Brittany, if I could just jump in on that latter question about those individuals incarcerated. We're working with Secretary Wetzel to set up a Senate Democratic policy hearing probably right after the first of the year to discuss this. I know that there's going to be a conversation about the status of the Philadelphia County jails, and we're looking to do something at the state level as well. So folks can look for a posting from us about when that policy hearing will be able to, you'll be able to watch it remotely. But that's an important question that our members are discussing right now. Thank you.
I mean, with all the challenges in those congregate settings, in terms of the state corrections under Secretary Wetzel, they've actually had better outcomes, better testing, and better keeping the virus out than almost any other state in the United States. And so, you know, incredibly challenging, and Secretary Wetzel and his team have done a good job in terms of the state correctional institutions.
All right, we're also getting questions from our listeners online, and one that's come up a few times is whether you need to get the COVID vaccine if you've already had COVID.
Mm-hmm. Excellent question, yes. So having had COVID before does not mean that you should not get the vaccine. You should get the vaccine. We don't know how long antibodies to COVID-19 last, and we don't know how long the immune system and the immune response lasts. There has been some suggestion that if you had a more severe case, then the immune response might be more robust. If you had a very mild case, maybe it doesn't last as long, but we don't really know. And so it is recommended that you get the vaccine.
All right, I think we have time for one more call from our live audience here. Let's go to Arthur, who's calling us from Squirrel Hill.
Yeah, hi. What would be the cost of the vaccination? Will it be covered by insurance, and will you be monitoring price gouging by the pharmaceutical companies?
So there is no cost to the vaccine. The federal government has already pre-purchased all of the vaccines, and so there is no cost. It doesn't need to be covered by insurance. There is possibly going to be a vaccination cost, meaning a cost for giving the vaccination, That will be covered by all insurance companies, including Medicaid and Medicare. And if someone is completely uninsured, then it will be covered by a federal agency called HRSA. Cindy, can you check me on that?
Sure. And I think a bigger message is there is no barrier financially to receive this vaccine. If you're going into a pharmacy or your doctor's office and they have an administrative fee and you're not able to pay for it, it gets waived and you receive the vaccine.
So there should be no cost to anybody in the United States for the vaccine.
All right, Senator, that's going to take us to the end of our time. If you'd like to do any closing remarks or hear from our guests one more time.
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to thank Dr. Levine and Cindy and Randy for their time on the call and answering all these questions that our folks had in our community here, and thoughtful questions and great answers. So those folks who had a question, weren't able to get through, we're going to continue to capture those questions, and we'll respond to your questions, each of your questions, as we go forward over the course of the next several days and this week. We'll be reaching out to the Department of Health to get those answers, to answer those questions. Dr. Levine, thank you. A couple times folks referenced the great work that we believe you're doing, I believe you're doing, and it's been a pleasure over these many months working with you, as you know, in our leaders call, et cetera. Your information has been extremely helpful, and your leadership in this space has been outstanding. So thank you for the work that's being done. Randy and Cindy, you as well, thank you for being with us today. And if you have any closing comments you'd like to have, Dr. Levine, I'll let you close it out.
Well, I would like to thank you, Senator, for all of your collaboration and your leadership in this regard. We appreciate it so much and look forward to continuing to work with you, and we can come back and do another town hall sometime.
Looking forward to it. Thank you very much. Brittany, you want to close it out?
Absolutely. I want to thank everyone for their participation. If you have additional questions or concerns, you can call Senator Casa's office at any time. That phone number is 412-241-6690, or you can visit his website at senatorcasa.com, where there is a contact form. If you're still on the line with us and your question wasn't answered, I'm sorry we weren't able to get to you today, but if you stay on the line, we'll get a record of your question and someone from the office will reach out to you in the next few days. So thank you again for participating. You've been a wonderful audience, and thank you for sharing your afternoon with us.
Thanks, everyone. Have a good evening now. Thank you.